Hello, my name is Ben Jenkins, and welcome back to another episode of the New Guard Radio Podcast. As registered nurses, we are so fortunate to work in a profession that can offer so much diversity. Whether you're working in critical care areas such as intensive care or emergency, in the operating theatre, on cruise ships, in prisons, in rural remote areas, you name it, there is just so much that we can do. There is one area of nursing that I believe that a lot of people have thought about at one time or another. I certainly know that I have. It's an area that can offer excitement, travel, autonomy, challenge, diversity, you name it. There is so much that can be offered within this job. On today's episode, I'll be interviewing Nick Coleman-Hicks, who currently works as a flight nurse with the Royal Flying Doctor Service. Hailing from Sydney, Nick worked within areas such as intensive care and emergency, and has completed a variety of postgraduate qualifications, including a grad cert in critical care nursing, as well as a grad dip in midwifery, and has gained some relevant experience practicing as a midwife, which is vital for working with RFDS. Within today's episode, we start off by talking about how Nick got into nursing. We've talked about his nursing progression, working within ED, ICU, and a few of the other areas that he's worked within. And then we talk about a big area that I think a lot of people think about when they are going and considering Royal Flying Doctors in midwifery. I think a lot of people see studying and going into midwifery as a bit of a barrier to getting into an area such as the RFDS. But as Nick talks about, it is achievable if you really put in some hard work and effort. And it can offer so many more experiences to then get into an awesome career such as RFDS. Nick talks about what the Royal Flying Doctor Service is and the services that it provides. And I think you're going to be really excited about listening to just such a diverse career that Nick has had so far. So if you're interested in RFDS, this is definitely the episode for you. So I present to you my episode today interviewing Nick Coleman-Hicks. G'day, Nick, and thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast today.
No worries, Ben. Thanks for having me.
No, it's fantastic. So, Nick, just a little bit about yourself. You've started your Bachelor of Nursing at ACU. You've gone on to fill a variety of different positions as a nurse, including 3 years within intensive care. You've done time with 4 years within the emergency department. You've started giving some time and some service as a combat medical attendant in the Australian Army during your studies at uni. You've then gone on to do your midwifery, you've done postgraduate qualifications, and Nick, within a short period of time already, you've done absolutely so much. So just to get a bit of info about what got you into nursing in the first place.
Yeah, so I got into nursing straight from high school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I did a lot of history subjects and other things during high school, which was a whole hodgepodge of various things. And I knew that no matter what, I didn't want to be in an office. So that was really my big motivation. And I figured nursing would probably learn some useful things along the way. And turned out I really enjoyed it, more importantly. And so I've stuck with it since then. I did my new grad at Katoomba Hospital, which is a tiny little 100-bed hospital just west of Sydney, which was fantastic. A good mix of your really acute stuff and not so acute stuff as well, which I think was a really good way to get started in nursing. And did some ED there, which really gave me the bug for critical care, which I really enjoyed. That was fantastic. I moved back to Sydney, worked at Long Bay Jail Hospital, which was a completely different situation. So it's a 100-bed hospital in the Long Bay Correctional Facility complex, tiny town, whatever you want to call it, in eastern Sydney. And that was interesting, but not particularly clinically challenging. And from there, I got a job at the ICU, at an ICU in Western Sydney.
Oh, wow. I've certainly experienced that myself there, Nick, just going from ICU and then into emergency department. It is such a different mix. I can't imagine what it's like going from ED to ICU. That would be a completely different beast in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, the ED I worked at Katoomba is a tiny little hospital. So ideally, the sorts of hospitals aren't supposed to get the really acute stuff. But unfortunately, geography and our patients are not really cooperative in that manner. Mm. And so I'd often get, say, a nasty car crash on the Great Western Highway near Sydney. And the nearest hospital was the Blue Mountains Hospital. And weather wouldn't allow an aeromedical asset to retrieve the patient, as would often be the case, ideally. And so the patient had come to this tiny hospital with two nurses and one doctor instead. which is kind of weird being so close to Sydney, but because the geography there just didn't allow easy retrieval a lot of the time, we'd sometimes get some interesting cases. Other times, of course, we'd just be watching The Wire or Family Guy on a laptop in the apartment because there was no one there. But that, it wasn't often the case, mainly on night shifts.
Well, it seems like you've already had that sort of exposure to being in sort of rural and remote areas, and sort of needing to care for that critically unwell patient for that little while. I guess I've had that little bit of a luxury of starting in a major trauma centre in the middle of CBD. So it's I can't imagine what it's like to be in an area where you don't have all the major specialties, you don't have all of the big major equipment, and needing to rely on each other to try to get this patient through to then eventually get onto those bigger hospitals. I guess in a nutshell, that must be what it's like working with someone like the Royal Flying Doctors, for example.
Yeah, it can be. Working with the RFDS, we're really lucky in that they're given a huge amount of training. Like, one of the great things about the RFDS compared to other organisations is they really, really value training, which is great for all the clinical staff. And so we do get a bit of teamwork with the pilots. The pilots are really great. Yeah, they're not medical, but they pick up a lot just from, you know, just osmosis, so to speak. I think it'd be really helpful. But the thing with the pilots is they're always willing to give a hand, and they're always there. Except, of course, when they're flying the plane, which is a really big problem when it's just you. or potentially a doctor if the patient's sick enough. So we put a lot of planning into the jobs we do to try and avoid any onboard emergencies.
Sure. So you've spent all of this time, you've gained all of this experience within these variety of different places, including two of the biggest critical areas of emergency and ICU. Do you feel like those sort of experiences has helped you within your position now with RFDS?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think going from, doing a little bit of ED, like kind of dipping my toes in at Katoomba, and then doing a few years in ICU in a major tertiary centre. Because one of the things you get in a major tertiary centre is you get to see the latest and greatest in terms of technology.
Sure.
And you also get the best staff as well. And so you can learn from the best. And you get the sickest patients in the state as well. And you get to see sickness and illness and injury in such a detailed way that you're not going to see in any other place, with the chance to actually sit down and think about it, which I think is really valuable in ICU. You know, in the resus bay, yeah, you get people that are that sick, but it's all go, go, go.
That's
or
right.
The situation may not entirely be clear of what you're dealing with yet, and you've really got to get them to that next step in their journey. That's the whole point of resus. Whereas in ICU, you've got a bit of a story. Maybe there's a bit more to be figured out, but you've got the next 8, 12 hours, depending what sort of shift you're doing, to actually learn about it. And yeah, you've got to do your cares along the way, but once you get a bit proficient in ICU, you know, your normal cares can become almost just out of habit. And then you can actually learn about what's going on, which is really valuable. You don't get that chance in a lot of other areas, unfortunately, with this kind of tempo that most hospitals are dealing with these days. And that's the real value in ICU. You can learn ventilation back to front. You can learn your hemodynamic monitoring, how to read an ART line trace when it's working properly. How to optimize ventilation, get your patients really well. You don't get that anywhere else, really, that I can think of.
As you're speaking now, so I did my grad year in ICU. And I think starting off, of course, it's very difficult starting in that area.
Yeah.
But no, you're exactly right. Like you spend those first few months and solid almost year just really trying to get your head into the game of what is intensive care nursing. You start seeing these patients who are intubated and ventilated, and you're understanding sort of the concepts behind what's happening. But after a while, you can go so deep, and it's so very enjoyable being able to care for someone who is so critical and well. But especially when you start getting students of your own, you're sort of showing them how the way you're thinking through it. And exactly as you're right, and I've moved into ED this year, and you just don't have that luxury anymore. You might be caring for 7 acute patients at one stage, and it's more about task orientation, and you get very proficient at putting cannulas in and taking blood gases and taking ECGs and stuff. But no, you're exactly right. It's more about moving forward at pace as opposed to really going deep with what's going on. And I can definitely see that there's value for a registered nurse to see both areas as well.
But yeah, I did get a little bit, I'll be honest though, I did get a little bit bored after about 3 years in ICU. And I kind of, we, at the time we had a secondment program to, with the ED, where ICU and ED staff would switch. And so I gave it a go and I really loved it, especially resus. Like resus is just like, it's like getting a new ICU patient every half hour, an hour or so. And resus is fantastic. Like being able to marry up the skills and knowledge you got in ICU and then add a bit of adrenaline into it, you know, an unknown quantity of what's going on with the patient and the teamwork. Like, I still think back to some of the early shifts I did where we had three beds to two nurses, and I don't think I ever worked so well or closely with another staff member as when we just had those two resus nurses. But sometimes it would kind of not work so well, to be honest, but other times it was just like, you know, just fluidity in motion, it just worked so well. And with the doctors and the paramedics, yeah, resus was fantastic. But in the ED, it did have a few cases, particularly more in the triage in front of house kind of area, where they were obstetric related. And I kind of had no idea what I was doing. Yeah, right. I knew that, you know, blood coming out is bad generally for most patients. I think we can all agree on that. That's a good one. But then just that whole, it's almost that obstetric mystique about these sorts of patients, whether it's a early pregnancy bleeding or trauma in pregnancy as well. And I kind of kept thinking about how I had this massive gap in knowledge. And combined with that was I was getting a bit burnt out in ED, because ED is good fun. But after about 4 years, and especially in the tempo that our units are going through these days, the amount of patients that you're seeing. And one thing with the RFDS that I've seen is that it's everywhere. It's not just in Brisbane. It's not just in Sydney. It's all over the country. It's really easy to get burnt out in ED. And so I kind of gave it some thought, made the decision, well, I've got this gap in knowledge. It's a one-year course, which it was at the time, the graduate diploma in midwifery, which is where you're already an RN, but you want to dip your toes into become a midwife. So it was a one-year course. I figured it's not too much to lose. Worst comes to, I can quit and get back to ED or ICU. And so I put my application in for that. Work was okay with it. Didn't like what I was leaving, but anyway, you got to give them notice. Don't burn those bridges. And I got in. And it turned out I actually really enjoyed it, like a lot more than I thought I would. Midwifery is, it can be a lot more adrenaline. It can have a lot more adrenaline in it than you'd think. Like most of the time with most births, things are fine, which is actually really nice. You can sit down, have a chat with the woman, talk with the partner, do your regular assessments as the labor progresses, and eventually a baby comes out. Now there's some, you know, there's a lot of stuff in between there, but it can actually be really nice just talking through that. And it's a natural process. That's just really the great thing about it. It's not a disease process, but sometimes things do go wrong. Sometimes you do get obstetric emergencies out of nowhere. And those times I felt it was really great being an ED nurse, because jumping into resus mode was kind of second instinct by then. And again, not common, but when it did happen, I felt it was really useful, like, and really great learning experience. Didn't have too many really bad outcomes, which is great. And the vast majority of births I was involved in were really fantastic, and really, really awesome experiences.
So Nick, you've done the grad dip itself, and obviously has a lot of placement time as a student midwife, and did you go into then being a midwife and working just as a midwife for a period of time, or were you sort of splitting between ED as well? How did that work?
Yeah, so the way it worked in New South Wales, I can't really speak for Queensland, is you get hired by the local health district, so the LHD, as a student midwife, but you're paid as a registered nurse. So I was paid my full registered nurse wage as a part-time position. Then one day a week was at the university, and that was obviously not paid, but that's just your usual 8 hours in the uni doing your theoretical discussions and tutorials and stuff, just like you would for any other degree or diploma. And then for the 4 days, I was a staff member within the birth unit, within the maternity ward, within the antenatal ward, depending on where I'd been allocated. So you do rotations in different areas. In the birth unit, at least for the first two or so rotations, you're basically supernumerary. You're buddied up with a midwife. Mm-hmm. So the expectation is that you're not managing labouring women on your own. And so you get that chance to kind of sit back and learn and be a student, which is actually, when you get to, like, once you're an established registered nurse, that's pretty rare, and it was fantastic. Oh, exactly. It was actually really great being able to just, you know, plumb these fantastic clinicians and get really awesome experiences and be a part of it, which was really good. The obstetricians there were great as well. But still being paid my full registered nurse wage, I was like, holy crap, this is it's like a scam.
Well, you're doing exactly what you're after too. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was really great. There was one aspect being a male in what is overwhelmingly a female dominated, not even profession, but area. There's lots of oxytocin and estrogen around. So that took a while to get used to. But at the same time, really, it wasn't as big a deal as I thought it would be. Sure. What I found was the big trap is when sometimes the senior midwives, and meaning well, would introduce you as this is Nick, he's a male midwife. Do you want him to look after you today? And that's kind of, I found that put me on the back foot because then there's that expectation that's something different. Whereas I found that if I went in and I introduced myself and said, g'day, my name's Nick. I'm a midwifery student. I've worked in emergency and ICU for about 6-7 years. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to help you help where this other midwife is, Marie, manage your birth today. And you're like, score, extra clinician. All this experience, why, as if you wouldn't. Like, and when you frame it that way, I found it worked a lot better. The biggest mistake, though, which I saw some medical students do more than anyone else, is to stand in the back corner, hold your hands, be nervous. And then, of course, any woman's going to be like, who's this weirdo in the back, you know, while I'm pushing a baby out? Like, come on, kick him out. Whereas if you just go in there and own it and kind of introduce yourself, goes all the long way. There are, like, the area I worked in was, the hospital I worked in, was in a very culturally and linguistically diverse area.
Oh, okay.
So there were some backgrounds where having a male in the room, regardless of whether they're a midwife, anaesthetist, obstetrician, janitor, whatever the case may be, was seen as being taboo. But often the vast majority of women, when that baby's coming out and push is coming to shove, they just want that baby out. They don't really care who's involved as long as they can trust them. And that's really what midwifery is. It's that building rapport and trust and looking after the woman and baby, which was like in nursing, it's such a rewarding experience a lot of the time. And it's a real privileged position of being, particularly in the ICU or in the ED. When you think about the questions we're asking, the things we ask, we put our patients through. Midwifery is the same. It's a real privilege to be part of what is an amazing part of, like, one of the most important parts of anyone's day or life. It's really fantastic. I really enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would, to be honest.
You still love it. Yeah. I was just going to ask. So you've just, if you looked back at that time and even now, when you were thinking, oh, I might just want to dip my toes in, I really want to know more about midwifery and the expectations you might have had of yourself, do you feel like that year and that period of time doing the grad dip, was it everything that you expected it to be? Did you learn as much as you'd hoped that you've learned? Do you feel more confident at midwifery after that?
Definitely. Like a lot more confidence with women with any sort of high-risk birth type situations. I mean, even normal birth. Like, I remember seeing the first normal birth that I ever saw was in an emergency. It was a woman who came in, brought in by New South Wales ambulance, who claimed she wasn't pregnant, was acting incredibly pregnant when she was in labour. I was at triage and began to do the triage. I was just listening to this woman. I was like, there's no way she's not pregnant. It's like, if she's not pregnant, something nasty's going on. Just take her into resus. And but actually, hang on, before you do, let me check. I just looked under the bed, and sure enough, there was a head coming out. I was like, holy crap. Which was a bit embarrassing for the woman and for her partner who was there. Her mother was overjoyed, though, which I think was really nice. So at least someone was happy. And even in that situation where no one was prepared, everything went fine. Baby came out. the mum didn't have any significant bleeding or any issues. She was certainly in a state of shock, but yeah, it's just, it is a normal process most of the time, which is really nice. In terms of what did I get out of it? Yeah, heaps. There's still, I think, probably one part of the midwifery course that I did find a little bit disappointing, which I did find surprising, was there wasn't a huge amount on your early pregnancy emergencies. Mm. And a big part of the reason there is because there's not much for the midwife to be involved in. Involved in there, except really the peer support and the support to the woman. So that early pregnancy loss, ectopic pregnancy, those are overwhelmingly medical conditions, though, a lot of the time. But things like miscarriage, like women suffering miscarriages presenting the ED, is a really big part of what you do see in emergency, and how to talk through that subject with women I found it really difficult. I still sometimes do, but I certainly feel better equipped. But it's always going to be a difficult thing to talk about. I think, yeah. But overwhelmingly, it was doing midwifery was a really positive experience. And one thing I did do, which I think helped me through it, because it was a difficult course. It's a 1 year, what is often a 2 year course now. It's a 1 year course where you're basically on call because you've got follow throughs. So you've got women that you recruit over the year to follow through their pregnancy. And often babies are not born exactly when you would like them to be, which can be very frustrating. I did have that experience of being called at about 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, hi, Nick, when are your women's giving birth? Are you going to come in? Like, I guess it was. I had one time where I was having a really nice family dinner, and I got the call. Fortunately, I hadn't had any alcohol. And it was actually a woman that I'd really bonded with over our follow-through period. And I really, really wanted to be there. But she was a third baby, which... one of the few things you can count on to speed a labour up is the fact that they've already had a few kids.
That's all right.
And she's 9 centimetres.
Oh,
crap. There's no way I'm going to make it. But I got on my boner bike, because I had a motorbike at the time, and I jetted the 20Ks or so, and I managed to get there in time. The unit was in chaos, as it often is, because birth units are very busy. And fortunately, she was still sitting more or less at the same spot. But unfortunately, she had 2 kids with her. Her 4-year-old and her 6-year-old were bouncing off the walls because these guys had only recently come to Sydney and they didn't have any family that were able to look after the kids. So her partner was there. I kicked the kids out to the TV room. Wished that I had an iPad with me because that would have just distracted them fantastically, but here's what you got. And then her water broke, which was the first time I'd actually seen the proper explosive rupture of membranes that you see on the TV all the time, which doesn't always happen. But this is the first time I'd seen that. And when it happened, I was like, oh, we better check where you're up to. So she got on the bed and she actually turned to an all fours position, which is much better physiologically for the baby to be born. And as she did that, the head began to crown. I was like, oh, fantastic. So hit the little yellow button we've got, the assist button, to get an extra pair of hands, because you always want an extra person around just in case during a birth. And it's talking through breathing and with the woman. Then the door opens. It's like, great, it's the team leader. She'll come drop the Cinto for me, the oxytocin. Mm-hmm. And that I checked, it's actually the 2 boys. Oh. And they had this look on their face of just complete horror and confusion at this strange person who was, you know, this head coming out. Everyone's just like, oh no.
Oh no.
And then of course the woman just turned around and said, get up out, and they screamed, which was great. And then the team leader came in and was like, oh, I've got a couple of witnesses, that's lovely. Baby Cinto, baby was born, everything was fine, it's a lovely birth. So just moments like that, which are pretty much every day in midwifery, but really pleasant and fond memories.
Oh, Nick, what absolute experiences you've had there. What I love about it, though, is that you've come into it, you feel like it's time for a bit of a change, and it sounds like you've had an overwhelmingly positive experience, that you've gotten so much from it, exactly what you're going in there to do. So that's fantastic. And by the sounds of it, that set you up incredibly well with the ICU and ED stuff to then start transitioning into RFDS. what was the sort of catalyst for wanting to look at that? Did you have in mind already as you were going into midwifery that RFTS was on the cards, or was it just something that came afterwards?
Well, it was something that in the back of my mind, I knew that if I looked back on my nursing career and I hadn't done it at one point, I'd probably be pretty disappointed. But it wasn't necessary. I didn't watch the TV show like some people have. I think I watched a lot more ER than RFDS or police rescue. It wasn't like a overwhelming passion, but it was something that I did want to do at some point. Mm. So when I completed my grad dip of midwifery, I stayed on to do a new grad program, but part-time. So I did a split roster of half ED and half midwifery, which was really great. So, which is good just to consolidate those skills. But at the same time, when I did my grad dip, I did stay and do one 12-hour shift a fortnight, just to kind of kept me sane, I think, because while midwifery was really nice, it's a super busy time. You've got assignments, you're basically working more or less full time. So just having that 12 hours once a fortnight where I'm like, I know what I'm doing here at triage or resus really made a big difference. So then going back and doing a split roster, that was a really great place to be. But I did kind of send out a couple of the RFDS and other organisations usually have an expression of interest kind of form open to anyone that wants to pursue flight nursing. So I sent one of those out and I got a call a few weeks later asking if I was interested in a position that was going to come up later in the year, which worked well for me because I wanted to keep consolidating that midwifery knowledge, and I still really enjoyed working in the ED and the people I was working with, and also just to get my life in order at the time. So then I accepted a position at RFDS Rocky, which is a really great base in central Queensland, very busy. We deal with pretty much every sort of patient you can ever think of, predominantly into hospital transfers rather than primary jobs. So a primary job is where we land at the scene of the accident, so to speak. Helicopters are much more suited for that, except when you get out west where the distances become so much longer and a fixed wing platform makes sense for a primary retrieval. One of the busiest bases in the country, busiest in the state, which has definitely been interesting for the last couple of years here, working for the RFDS.
Nick, just for the bit of an international audience that may be listening to this, in a nutshell, what is the Royal Flying Doctor Service?
So the Royal Flying Doctor Service was founded, what year was it? Just about 91 years ago by Reverend John Flynn. And he was a reverend working in a very rural community out near Mount Isa, I think it was near Cloncurry, where he noticed a need for basically medical care in these really rural, remote areas where there was little or no resources. There might be a doctor available, or there might be a sister or a nurse, but there wasn't actually any sort of hospital or facility, or not anything substantial. And so he kind of pioneered this idea of flying patients to where they needed to go, or flying the doctor with the patient or to the patient, whatever the case might be. And so he hooked up with the local Qantas, it was Qantas basically, because that's where it was more or less where it was founded. Rented an aircraft, a very simple aircraft, as you can imagine, being back in the early 20th century, and kind of pioneered this idea of what would become eventually aeromedical retrieval. And so that organisation has lived on for over 90 years now, and still continues to this day with that same kind of vision of either bringing health to the patients or bringing the patients to where they can get more help. And we've got other technology these days. We've got jets, well, at least some areas of some sections of the RFDS do, but we've all got some pretty advanced fixed wing aircraft. Got telecommunications, which make a big difference in Queensland. We've got things like mobile dental unit.
Oh. Yeah, right. So it's very interprofessional team as well.
Tiny town. Yeah, yeah. So it's not just the you've got your aeromedical transfers, which are kind of what you think of being as typical RFDS work, but there's also the primary healthcare aspect. So it's bringing GPs to areas that don't have doctors, bringing obstetricians to areas that don't have obstetricians, that kind of thing as well. And there's one thing that I think is really great is it's one thing if you're in an area that doesn't have a cath lab, it makes sense to take a patient to somewhere that has a cath lab. But where the technology allows it, it makes more sense to bring the service to the patient, if that's possible. So things like obstetric care and primary health care. And who knows, maybe in the future they'll have a mobile cath lab unit driving around. Things might change.
Wow.
But so that's basically what the RFDS does.
No, fair enough. So then you've started in, it sounds like you've had an incredible sort of induction. You keep mentioning about the training and the level of training that you receive. I'm guessing there was quite a few courses that you're needing to do before you get your first call out.
Yeah, so there's a few acronyms I can think of because they're all acronyms these days. So you got your PALS, your ALS, obviously. You got your TNCC, Trauma Nursing Core course. There's also midwifery-specific courses like MIDAS or ALSO, which are midwifery or obstetric emergency courses. There's a preference for people to have some sort of postgraduate study as well, but it's not necessarily mandatory. But really, it's the experience they're after. So that's really the thing is, if you're in the back of an aircraft and it's maybe it's a very sick patient, and you do have a doctor with you, even that extra pair of hands, the two of you are trying to get an art line up, trying to get the ventilator running, trying to get your access going, trying to get all these medications working through that access. You need to be able to do that stuff fairly instinctually. Like you can't really learn on the job, that kind of thing. That needs to be knowledge that is well-founded within the person, which is kind of one of the biggest barriers. So midwifery is definitely a barrier. Because we deal with a lot of obstetric emergencies or patients that might suffer an obstetric emergency at a very inopportune moment. And so we do need people to have midwifery, which is one of the requirements. But the critical care knowledge is really important as well. You don't want to be up at 26,000 feet trying to work out and troubleshoot an art line alone without that experience.
No, it's definitely something to consider for some people, especially on the websites and everyone as well. You're looking through, minimum time is 3 years, and I think people are trying to like shoot for that 3 years. But by the sounds of it, when you're up in the back of the aircraft, as you mentioned, you've got very minimal hands. You can't call anyone else in because you're so high above the ground. There is no one else to bring in. There is no more pieces of equipment. It's just you and possibly that doctor as well.
And it's also troubleshooting, and sometimes you've got to MacGyver equipment a little bit to make it work for you as well. And that's where that experience really comes in.
You've had both of those experiences in ICU and ED. Would you think that one over the other, or do you think it's good for people to sort of get both? Or what's your opinion on that?
Well, I would say ICU for the technical skills, but ED for a lot more of the CRM and what we call, the non-technical skills. Because you're often working as a sole operator, so to speak, you need to be able to voice your concerns and things like graded assertiveness, but also just being able to work with an ad hoc team, which I think is something that ED does really well. So I would say both, realistically. I think ED is good because you get that wide range of conscious, unconscious patients. You get that. You deal with probably a lot more acute psych stuff as well, which we do deal with as well. So I think that's kind of how I'd break it down. Ideally, you'd really want both. If you had to go just one, I think we've got nurses that have just ICU or have just ED, and I shouldn't say just, but you get my meaning. So we do have people who are kind of a bit more siloed that way, and you pick your other skills up along the way. Because one of the great things of the RFDS is we do a lot of planning to prevent these kind of onboard emergencies. They're actually pretty rare that we have something go down that's really nasty on during a flight. But the main reason for that is we plan a lot, and a lot of this is planning done by not just us, the flight nurse, but also by RSQ, who we work with. So that's Retrieval Services Queensland. They kind of work as a coordination centre for not just us, but also for LifeFlight and all the other agencies in Queensland. So they're the ones that actually give us the taskings, and we look at the tasking and go, ooh, yeah, that should be all right, but I'll call up and get a handover on the phone just to find out, make sure that's the whole story. Sometimes something's been omitted, usually by accident, and sometimes we need to reorganize and replan things out again. Of course, patients are unpredictable. Sometimes it turns out that fear of flying that they say isn't that bad is actually really, really bad. That's probably one common thing. And, of course, our patients change. They're not static. A patient that's well 1 hour is unwell in about 3 or 4 hours later. That's just part of the deal, unfortunately. It's about recognizing that and dealing with it appropriately.
So Nick, I'm probably going to ask you a bit of a loaded question here. It might be something a bit too bit hard to sort of condense down, but what would a typical day for you as a flight nurse with the RFDS look like?
So a typical day, say for a day shift, or a day one, starts on the clock at 6 o'clock, 6 a.m. But we actually don't come in until we're paged, unless it's later in the day. So often RSQ will page us probably at about, say, 6:15, say, be one of the ENDs, the emergency medical dispatchers, saying, "G'day, Nick, I've got a job for you. We've got a P3 out of Barcaldine going down to Brisbane." And then mine or might not be a doctor job. I'll say, "Sweet, I'll call you back later." So then I'll head back into base from home. Fortunately, I live about 5 minutes away, so that makes it nice and easy.
Very convenient.
And begin the checks. If the pilot's there, we'll begin planning the things like, do we need a C-level cabin? I'll try and get a quick phone handover from the nurse looking after the patient currently at, say, Barcaldine, preferably before about 7 o'clock. It's always better if you can catch the night crew, because they will have been with the patient for a while, whereas if I catch them after 7, it'll be the day crew that just starts. So planning things like that. Get the gear ready, pack the plane. We'll give an ETA to Retrieval Services Queensland. And then when we land at Barcaldine, if it's suitable, we'll pick the patient up from the tarmac and carry on. But every day is a bit different. It's not uncommon at all to have a good plan with your pilot, have an idea of how your day is going to go, and then it all gets changed because the higher acuity patients come up. We can get paged at about 5 o'clock in the morning, so an hour before for a priority one as well. So I have had that relatively unpleasant experience of, you know, being asleep and the phone goes off. You got to go. Or walking the dogs before a day shift, only to be halfway down the hill before I get a page and I've got to run back up with the poor dogs being a bit confused about what's going on. And that's much the same for either a night shift or any other shifts. They're very fluid, but basically we get given a task, go and aim to retrieve that patient. And if the plan stays on, we'll get given another job until we eventually head back home to base at the end of shift. One good thing about the RFDS is we're very much guided by our pilot's fatigue hours. So it's unlikely that I'll get a new job from about, say, 3 or 4 o'clock if I'm finishing at 6 p.m. because the pilots can't work over hours. And the obvious thing being as well, because we need to end up back home. Because if we don't end up back home, not only does that lengthen our shift, but it means there's no aircraft for the next shift, which is the other thing we've got to consider. It's all about providing coverage or a mantle of safety, which is one of the RFDS taglines to the local area.
And the way that it sort of works with your guidelines as well, the Royal Flying Doctors, do they use the primary, what is it, critical care?
PCCM.
PCCM, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, we do. We use that one pretty thoroughly. So the big ones you can imagine for us would be acute pain and nausea. The health management protocols in there. We do have a couple of extras that aren't in there, which mainly deal with management of the an agitated patient, because again, it's pretty rare, but it has happened in other sections of the RFDS, so not in Queensland, but where patients become extremely agitated, requiring unexpected sedation, and so having a plan there in place of what to do is really important. To get control of that situation. Because if you had a patient that suddenly went for the door or went for the pilot, there's only a nurse in the back of the aircraft, that could be really catastrophic. Fortunately, relatively rare. Again, that goes into planning. Any patient where that's recognised as being a risk, we're going to have extra personnel on board to try and avoid that.
And what's it like from your experiences, Nick, when you are the only clinician in the back? That must be very intimidating.
First starting it was, yeah. So when I first started, that was probably one of the big fears, is like, oh, what happens if this happens and I need to, what happens if the patient has a cardiac arrest? But really, when you boil down to it, you're going to do whatever you can at the time. You know, maybe I wouldn't exactly do compressions immediately. I'd probably just get pads on immediately because that's something I can fix quickly on my own. And if that doesn't work, then yeah, I'm doing compressions. But realistically, you do what you can. It has happened where a patient's had an unexpected cardiac arrest and a flight nurse alone has managed that on her own while the pilot gets the aircraft back to ground. And that patient had a really good outcome. Scared the hell out of the flight nurse, as you can imagine. Would.
My goodness.
But you kind of, a big part of that is, again, it comes into planning. You kind of brainstorm in your mind and say, if this happens, if this patient starts vomiting, what am I going to do about it? Well, I've already given some ondansetron, so that should hopefully mitigate that risk. I've talked through the patient, what they're going to do, given them a vomit bag, something simple like that. If this patient gets chest pain and develops a, and that worsens, what am I going to do? Well, I've already had a brief with them about what to make sure they let me know if they have chest pain. I'll give them some fentanyl or GTN, depending on what's appropriate with their blood pressure. And obviously then communicate that to RSQ on the sat phone and say, hey, this guy's got chest pain. I think we need to get into the hospital a little faster. Do a 12-lead ECG, interpret if there's any changes. So it's kind of little things you just kind of plan in your head. What are you going to do about it? Sometimes there's not much you can do about it, and that's when you just got to accept the limitations of just being a solo practitioner.
So just being cognizant of time, because I very much just appreciate your time today, Nick. Just winding down, when it comes to your career coming up next, what's coming up next for you?
I don't know. I get itchy feet pretty regularly, as you might have noticed rattling off my resume back there. I'm enjoying what I'm doing for now, and kind of my philosophy with work is that if I'm not enjoying it, I should do something different. And so as long as that's the case, I'll probably stick with the RFDS. I've been doing kind of an educator role in Rocky for the last few months. So I'll probably continue that for the next while. And I wouldn't mind doing some remote area nursing, which is probably what I'm thinking about for the next step, because, working with the RFDS, I've met some fantastic remote area nurses. And so that would be something I wouldn't mind doing. Or maybe some more kind of maybe some picky nursing for a little while as well. We look after a lot of kids. I'm in a weird place because I'm actually really comfortable looking after neonates, comfortable looking after adults, but that kind of in between, I'm still a bit, ooh. You know, the RFDS has given some really great training for pediatric ALS and pediatric emergency courses, but it's still kind of a gap in my experience that I'd like to rectify at some point. But I have definitely gotten better working the RFDS out of, because we move a lot of kids. And they can be quite fun to look after, to be honest. But there are definitely challenges compared to when you're working with an adult. So that's my kind of non-committal answer. But I've got a little while to figure it out. So.
Oh, that's yeah. Cool. And if someone's listening to this episode today and they are dead set, they might be even at uni at the moment and they're considering that all they want to do with their career and they are so excited they want to become exactly what you are right now that you've worked so hard to get as a flight nurse, what sort of advice would you provide to them, even something in regards to even a career plan or anything like that?
Take your time and don't rush. Like, get into your critical care, be it ED or intensive care, and learn everything you can there, particularly in the ICU or in the resus bay. Because that knowledge, when you've got people around that you can just plug knowledge from them, from your senior ED doctors, your senior ED nurses, that is really valuable. That experience will have you in such good stead later on in your career. If you go on to do midwifery, that knowledge is still really useful, whether it's your technical or your non-technical skills. So definitely get into ED or ICU and just plumb the depths of knowledge that are available there. But don't rush into flight nursing. Flight nursing's fantastic, and it will still be there when you get up there in the years. There's no need to rush. That would be my advice.
Thank you so much, Nick, and very much appreciate your time for being on the podcast today.
No worries, Ben. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And if someone was interested as well, is there a sort of website that you'd be linking them to?
As in for the RFDS or?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Just any sort of research. Yeah,
so in terms of clinical knowledge, I think Life in the Fast Lane is pretty much that gold standard for clinical information to find out. There's a few other great ones. There's like a MCRIT. One of the doctors of the RFDS has a fantastic podcast called PHARM, PHARM, which is pre-hospital aeromedical retrieval medicine. run by Min. That's a really great podcast as well. And the RFDS website, they do advertise fairly regularly as well for positions all over the country, not just in Queensland, but in WA and Southeast Corner and Central Ops. But there's so much great clinical knowledge out there these days. You've got to be a bit critical about it, but yeah, life in the fast lane is probably my go-to.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you for being on today.
No worries. Thanks, Ben.